Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. This is World in Focus with just me, Carolyn Scott, again today. But fear not, Jack Foster will be back from his adventures tomorrow. In the meantime, coming up on today's programme, Houthi rebels in Yemen have announced the lineup of a new government as doubts persist over hopes for peace in the war-wrecked country. We hear from the former US ambassador to Yemen, Gerald Firestein, this hour. Protesters at the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota have now launched a class action case against the law enforcement agencies over the use of extreme force. This is following reports of police using water cannons on protesters in freezing temperatures and explosive devices, which may yet result in one woman having her arm amputated. As Iraqi forces continue the offensive against Daesh, Sunni members of parliament are protesting what they see as a bill that grants undue legal rights to Shiite militias to fight in parallel with Iraqi military and police. Could the forthcoming US administration lead to action against Turkish political leader Fethullah Gulen? Turkey accuses Gulen of masterminding July's attempted coup and wants him detained or extradited by President-elect Donald Trump. The British government's investigatory powers bill, coined the Snoopers Charter, was given royal assent today amidst continuing protests against the bill and a very popular online petition to repeal the new laws. And those poor UFO spotters now state that aliens are utilising even more advanced technology to scupper their attempts to document invasions. All that and more over the next hour on this Tuesday edition of World in Focus. Yemen's Houthi rebels have announced the lineup of a so-called National Salvation Government. It comes as the United Nations try to revive peace efforts in the war-wrecked Arabian Peninsula country. The announcement of the 42-member body, headed by Abdelaziz bin Habtour, is likely to provoke a strong response from the government of President Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi. His forces have been battling the Houthi rebels and their allies since 2014. It could also be seen as a gesture of defiance aimed at the United Nations and the United States, who continue to advocate a national unity government that would include rebels and representatives of the current administration. Liam O'Hare spoke to the former US ambassador to Yemen, Gerald Firestein.
Well, the new cabinet was announced by the so-called Supreme Political Council. This was established earlier this year by the Houthis and their allies, supporters of former President Ali Abdullah Saleh. The announcement came after the UN envoy met the rebels in Muscat last week. A previous round of peace talks held in Kuwait collapsed in August, and a 48-hour ceasefire declared by the coalition ended last Monday, with little success in reducing the violence. Releasing the government line-up on Monday, the rebels said they were responding to President Hadi's stubbornness in continuing the war with the backing of the Saudi-led Arab coalition that intervened in March 2015. The United Nations says the war in Yemen has killed more than 7,000 people and wounded nearly 37,000 since March last year. Well, earlier I was joined by President Obama's ambassador to Yemen between 2010 and 2013, that's Gerald Firestein. I asked him how significant he believes the formation of this new rebel government is.
Well, I think it's significant mostly in a negative sense, and that is that it is an obstacle for the completion of the UN-led effort to resolve the conflict and promote a return to the political transition. I think that over the long term, this government is not a real government. It won't, in fact, form the future government of Yemen, but it will make the job of Ismail Sheikh Ahmed more difficult.
And do you think it could provoke a response from President Hadi? Government, will this see another escalation in this crisis?
I think that it's possible that it may lead to another escalation, or it may simply be the maneuvering that's going on before the parties actually sit down and begin to negotiate seriously. So I think at this juncture we need to wait and see what happens next.
What steps do you believe can be taken to achieving, firstly, a ceasefire, a lasting ceasefire, but also a lasting peace in Yemen?
My view, based on my own experience there, is that the fighting won't stop until the Yemenis are ready for it to stop. It's not going to be the result of outside intervention. But at a certain point, the Yemenis themselves will come to the conclusion that they are not going to make any further gains through a continuation of the conflict, and therefore it's time to return. I think that it's important for Ismail Sheikh Ahmed to continue his efforts to bring the parties back to the table and to try to create a framework that the parties can eventually agree on. But in the meantime, I think that we're likely to see more of the conflict.
Obviously, the responsibility lies with the two parties directly involved in the conflict, but is there also a responsibility on the outside parties involved? I'm thinking Iran on the side of the Houthis who are funding them and potentially supplying them with weapons, but also the United States and the United Kingdom who are supplying weapons to Saudi Arabia in this conflict as well.
I draw a distinction between the role of the Iranians and the role of the Saudis in this, and I believe that it's correct for the United States and the United Kingdom to continue to support Saudi Arabia.
Even selling weapons?
Yes, absolutely. The Saudis are operating within the framework of UN Security Council Resolution 2216. They're supporting the legitimate government of Yemen, which is, in fact, the position also of Washington and London in this conflict. So we can regret some of the consequences of the Saudi military intervention. There's no question about that. There have been things that have happened that are tragic. But that doesn't take away from the fact that their intervention is legitimate. Whereas on the Iranian side, I think that the Iranians primarily are motivated by an interest in destabilizing the Arabian Peninsula and provoking a Saudi response. And so I think it's important we do, both the UK and the United States, along with the other the other members of the Security Council, the Perm 5, continue to work with the Saudis, to encourage the Saudis to take positions in support of a political solution. The Saudis do support a political solution. I think it's also important that we put pressure on the government of Iran to stop their support for the Houthis.
You say that the Saudis support a political solution, but the United Nations has accused the Saudi-led coalition of grave and systematic violations of international humanitarian law in the conflict. Now, that includes the bombing of funerals, it includes the bombing of hospitals, and includes the bombing of wedding parties. Is it really appropriate to continue selling weapons when these are the sorts of acts that are being committed?
I think that there have been tragic consequences, tragic incidents in this conflict. The Saudis certainly can be held responsible, held accountable for some of the actions, some of the incidents that have occurred. But that doesn't take away from the overall fact that the Saudis are operating in support of legitimate government of Yemen at the invitation of the legitimate government of Yemen. Therefore, I think that we should continue to support them. I think it's also important to note that Saudi Arabia itself has been consistently attacked on nearly a daily basis by forces loyal to the Houthis and Ali Abdullah Saleh. And as a result of these cross-border attacks, they've actually had to evacuate urban centers along the southern border. So the Saudis have also suffered significant harm as a result of this conflict.
That was Gerald Feierstein, former US ambassador to Yemen. And earlier I was also joined by Professor Dr. Hans Koschler. He's the president of the International Progress Organization. He believes that the formation of the new government in Yemen is a sign of the desperation on the part of the rebels.
It is a very important move because it makes evident how desperate the people are about the fact that the peace negotiations under the auspices of the United Nations have led to no results. And somehow it is an expression of desperation on the part of one of the groups in the Yemeni civil conflict.
Are you concerned that it could potentially provoke a response from President Hadi's government?
President Hadi will, of course, not approve this move. And what I expect is that he will further ask foreign countries to increase their military measures. The problem is, as far as President Hadi is concerned, that in the year 2015 he did resign from his post as president of Yemen, and he did not revoke that resignation, and then he fled, as is known, abroad. So we are in a kind of constitutional quagmire in Yemen right now, and it is not so clear whether he really is the authority now to make any decisions on a sound legal basis concerning this new development.
What steps do you think need to be taken in order to see an end to the war in Yemen, but not just that, in order to see an actual lasting peaceful arrangement? What would you like to see happen? What does the international community have to do?
I mean, the problem we are faced with now is that in Yemen, as in other countries in the region, there is a kind of a proxy war between regional powers, and whenever such a situation occurs and a civil conflict is acquiring or getting such a larger dimension, it is very difficult to give any sound advice how to reach a lasting and peaceful settlement. But still, as it seems to me, the only option is that the international community should be neutral and should not be biased and should not, for instance, interfere on the side of one of the parties to the conflict against the other. And the United Nations also must keep its impartial attitude. Unless the United Nations organization is able to maintain, to stay in negotiating terms with both sides to conflict, the UN cannot achieve much. And the problem in regard to the Security Council may be that the Council has imposed an arms embargo last year, but only against one party to the conflict, against the Houthis. And so the position of the UN is imbalanced. But finally, as in any civil conflict, a solution can only be reached through negotiations between the parties to the conflict in the country itself. It can never be imposed from outside, or if it is, it will not last long.
Dr. Han Koshla, very, very interesting to get your thoughts. Thanks for joining us today on World in Focus.
You're welcome.
The Native American water protectors of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota have now filed a class action suit against the law enforcement agencies in North Dakota following reports of excessive force used against protesters. The protests over the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline have been ongoing for several months. The original pipeline was due to be built north of the city of Bismarck, North Dakota's capital, but concerns over the potential contamination of the water supply to Bismarck caused the construction to be moved south, directly through historic Native American lands. The actions of the private security services and police seem to have escalated. It's been reported this month that police have been using water cannons against the protesters in freezing conditions, including against many women and children. Earlier this month, one woman was hit with an explosive device and may yet have to have her arm amputated due to the extent of the injuries. Another woman may now be potentially blind, having been hit with rubber bullets in the eyes. There are numerous reports of minor injuries, and the Standing Rock Medic and Healer Council have released a statement in response to the use of water cannons, stating, quote, "As medical professionals, we are concerned for the real risk of loss of life due to severe hypothermia under these conditions." There have also now been two formal eviction orders given to the Standing Rock protesters by the North Dakota State Government and by the US Army Corps. Both have stated, though, that they will not forcibly remove the protesters. Earlier, I spoke to Professor Mark Clatterbuck, Professor of Religion at Montclair State University, who specialises in the indigenous religions of North America. Professor Clatterbuck visited the Standing Rock Reservation in September. I asked him for his thoughts on the lawsuit that the protesters have now filed.
I think the excessive force charges certainly seem justified in my mind. The charges, I hope, stand because the Morton County Sheriff's Department has clearly been using excessive force. And not just in clearing that camp back in October, but just two Sundays ago, there was another incident there with the land protectors where, you know, water cannons were used on peaceful land protectors in 24-degree weather, 24-degree Fahrenheit weather. So, you know, sub-freezing. And so I certainly hope the charges stick.
And there have been some very serious injuries. There's been reports of explosives being used. There's protesters that are potentially now blinded, and there's one that may lose her arm. Though already some commentators have said that the case will fail, as they allege that protesters themselves have been guilty of throwing stones at police and security personnel and have unlawfully vandalised private property. Do you think that there will be enough evidence of this kind of activity to really campaign against the case put forward by the protesters?
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. And I think one of the problems that the land protectors are facing is the, you know, essentially the media blackout that the local and state police have imposed on that situation. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, when I was out there back in September, my daughter and I witnessed the use of attack dogs and pepper spray on peaceful protesters, including children and women and elders. And there was one reporter who was there from New York City who she and her cameraman were there and recorded all of this and made it public afterwards. And she was charged with inciting riot and I think defiant trespassing charges. And she's not the only reporter. There's been a consistent campaign by the police force, local police force, to intimidate reporters and local media to keep them out. And numerous reports of local police shooting down, and I don't know if it's local police or state police or the National Guard, shooting down media drones that have been trying to cover the story. So it's very easy for law enforcement to just sort of make these claims when they're not allowing the media to come in and document what's going on. And so we're almost entirely relying on, you know, videos that are being made by non-mainstream media or the land protectors themselves, who are then putting this evidence, online on social media for us to access.
Mm-hmm. There's also two eviction orders now. The U.S. Army Corps and the North Dakota State Government have released statements this week stating that they will not forcibly remove protesters. But given the force that we've already seen, do you think that those statements really provide any comfort to the protesters?
Not at all. And I think, you know, they're really sending very mixed messages, and it's hard to understand what's going on at this point, because the Army Corps of Engineers, when they issued their statement, they certainly made it sound like the December 5th date was basically an ultimatum. But it was unclear. They didn't say how they planned to enforce that or what measures would be taken to enforce it. So then I think it was just, 2 days later that they clarified and said that the Army Corps of Engineers said they have no intention of forcibly removing people. But then we saw yesterday that the governor's office, Governor Jack Dalrymple of North Dakota, he seemed to come down very heavy and say that, in fact, citing the Army Corps of Engineers call for the clearing of that camp, the closure of the camp, the main camp, he said that the state itself was imposing a mandatory immediate evacuation order for the camp. And, you know, I think it's a real sort of tragic irony that the reason that Jack Dalrymple gave for closing the camp was for the health and safety and protection of the land protectors. Well, this is coming from the guy who has been firing water cannons and rubber bullets and tear gas, you know, local police in that state have been using these tactics against protectors. Clearly, they don't have the interest of the protectors, the land protectors in mind. So, no, I think they have every cause. I think the land protectors have every cause to be gravely concerned.
Do you think that there could be a legal case to look into the ownership of the land if these protesters say that they had the land taken from them and that they have a right to the land? Could we see a legal case happening over who owns the land?
Well, I don't know. That's obviously a huge issue here in the United States. You know, if that treaty, the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty, were to be seriously engaged by the federal government, you know, we have to look at, you know, scores and scores of similar treaties by tribes all over the country that were similarly broken and violated unilaterally by the federal government. I think, I mean, that would be a powerful step forward in the pursuit of justice for indigenous people in the U.S. But I think the more pressing issue is stopping construction of this line and protecting that community. And I think that's their focus now. But obviously, those larger questions would, I hope, continue after this struggle is over.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time today.
All right. Thank you.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, the right-wing parties in the French presidential elections have their candidates selected and are ready to start campaigning. But the left is looking more fractured than ever, with growing speculation over who will lead the socialists' campaign. We'll be taking a closer look at France's political left. As Iraqi forces continue the offensive against Daesh, Sunni members of parliament are protesting what they see as a bill that grants undue legal rights to Shia militias to fight in parallel with Iraqi military and police. Could the forthcoming US administration lead to action against Turkish political leader Fethullah Gulen? Turkey accused Gulen of masterminding July's attempted coup and want him detained or extradited by President-elect Donald Trump. And what on earth, or not on earth rather, will those nasty aliens think of next to avoid being spotted by UFO chasers? There's been fresh speculation this week over who will be the French presidential candidate for the left-of-centre socialists. The right-of-centre parties have their candidates confirmed. François Fillon will represent the Republicans, and of course Marine Le Pen will represent the far-right Front National. And already posters are stating that these elections will be a battle between the right and the far right. But what of the socialists? For some time now, there has been rumours that the current French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, will throw his hat in the ring for the socialist primaries. But that all really depends on whether or not the current president, François Hollande, decides to run for re-election. This week, Manuel Valls stated that, quote, there will be no confrontation between the president and the prime minister. Some commentators have taken this as a sign that Valls will not stand in the primaries, but reports within the party show a great deal of division over the issue. Joining me on the line to discuss this further is Professor James Shields, Professor of French Politics at Aston University. Professor Shields, what do you make of Valls' statement? Is this a sign that he won't run, or is he just leaving the ball in Hollande's court, saying he'll only run if Hollande doesn't?
That has been Manuel Valls' position all along, that he would run as a sort of reserve candidate if Hollande decided not to run. And what has happened recently is that this has become a bit blurred by the suggestion that Valls made in an article at the weekend that he would be ready to run even if Hollande does throw his hat in the ring. And that would change the dynamic between president and prime minister, because Valls has said all along he wouldn't challenge as president, but he would seek to take his place if Hollande doesn't run. On the other hand, if he is suggesting now that he would run regardless, then again, the dynamic between the two would really become impossible at this point.
There's also a bit of division within the party over whether or not they should both run. Reuters reporting that the head of the lower house, Claude Bartolin, said that both of them should run, whilst the Socialist Party spokesperson, Olivier Faure, said that if Valls ran, it would be, quote, collective suicide and would destroy the left. Now, given all these different views within the Socialist Party, are we looking at quite a divided party already, regardless of who runs, really?
The Socialist Party is very deeply divided. And we have to say that historically this has been a factionalised party, and nothing shows up those divisions quite like a presidential election. And it's not restricted to the leftists. I mean, historically, both the left and the right, the centre-left and the centre-right, have really suffered from their respective divisions in the run-up to presidential elections. And that's why these primaries have been brought in both by the socialist left and by the Republicans' right. They've been brought in to, if you like, sort out the fighting, sort out the divisions, sort out the splits before it gets to the presidential election, because the biggest problem, the biggest danger in a presidential election first round is that two big beasts from from the same side stand against one another. And this is how the differences used to be resolved in the past. We look at cases like Jacques Chirac and Edouard Balladur, or Valéry Giscard d'Estaing and Jacques Chirac, and others on the left too, standing against one another, cancelling one another out in the first round, and neither of them qualifying for the runoff. That's the danger. So the function of these primaries is to resolve all of that now, to get a single candidate for the Republicans on the right, for the Socialists on the left, who can go forward as the standard bearer of that whole camp. So the question would be, does Manuel Valls throw his hat in the ring for the primaries to stand against Hollande, to stand up, to debate with him, to argue why he would be a better candidate to take forward the standard of the Socialists into the fight, or whether it would be Hollande? But regardless of the outcome, it should be solved by the time the primary is over, and a single candidate should go forward. So what we're not talking about here is Manuel Valls challenging François Hollande in the first round of the presidential election. That indeed would be suicide.
Given Hollande's approval ratings, they're not exactly that good right now, can he really stand up and say, I am standing again for re-election because I think it's the best thing for the party?
Well, he will. He will find a way of saying that. He will indeed find a way of saying that. He'll put himself forward as the best thing for the party, and he will have to argue his case against six others who are in the frame for the primaries. So Hollande is already facing six colleagues who want to take him on, and there are other declared candidates from the left who are going to run in any case and are not going to pass through the process of the primaries. So the left at the moment is really in a fragmented state. What Hollande will be thinking is this, though. He will be delighted to have seen the election of François Fillon, because François Fillon makes an ideal target for François Hollande. And knowing that Marine Le Pen is already a candidate, what Hollande might be thinking is this. He could hope that if he runs, he would be able to mobilise an electorate of the left resolved to prevent a runoff between Fillon and Le Pen. If you like to caricature it, a runoff between the French Thatcher and Farage. So that Hollande would be saying to the entire electorate of the left, you have to come out in the first round of the election and vote for me, sort of incumbent socialist president who's seeking re-election, to prevent something a lot worse, which would either be the election of Fillon or Le Pen. That's how he will frame it. That will be his hope, and we'd have to say that's his only hope, because as you rightly say, he is in such desperate straits in terms of his own personal popularity, and again, to come back to this question of division, and in terms of the divisions of his camp.
And one of those candidates that has said they would stand regardless, I believe, is Jean-Luc Mélenchon. If he does stand on the left, and then you have whoever it might be for the Socialists, say Hollande perhaps, and then you have Fillon and Le Pen, that arguably is a four-way split. So perhaps, you know, it's not going to... Well, the right and the left would both be divided. Surely that's quite a democratic way of doing it.
It is, and the argument for the more the merrier in terms of candidates is exactly that. You know, it's a democratic election. But it's not just Mélenchon, and it's not just Macron. There are others. There's a workers' struggle candidate already declared. There's an anti-capitalist candidate already declared. There's a Green candidate already declared. There's a radical socialist leftist candidate already declared. So there are already 6 candidates from the left who are definitely going to stand. They're not going to go through the primary. They're definitely going to go seek to stand in the presidential election. So Hollande would be adding his name, if it was Hollande. Valls would be adding his name, if it was Valls, to that long list already of left-wing candidates who want to stand. Now, dispersal is the biggest danger in a first round. And what we seem to be moving towards here on the left is the kind of divided left that saw Jean-Marie Le Pen beat Lionel Jospin, who was at the time Socialist Prime Minister, and he was running for the presidency. This was in 2002. Le Pen beat him because there were 8 candidates of the left contesting the first round, and the dispersal of the left-wing vote was enough to eliminate the Socialist Lionel Jospin from the race and allow the far-right Le Pen to qualify for that runoff against Jacques Chirac. Now, that's the shadow hanging over this primary election and indeed this presidential election for the left. Could that happen again? And one sure way of making it happen again is to disperse the vote so much that no single candidate can get a critical mass bigger than, say, Fillon's and Le Pen's, and therefore would be eliminated.
And of course, right now, there is a lot of talk of this being the right versus the far right, Fillon versus Le Pen, and that's because of the Brexit vote and the vote for Donald Trump and this rising support that they're seeing for the right and for Euroscepticism. Could we not also argue, though, that now that those votes have happened, the left should be mobilised and should be looking, going, OK, there is something happening here. Now is the time for us to get together and say, right, we're going to get behind this one candidate and we're going to vote for the left.
That is, as I said, the scenario that Hollande will be clinging to right now as he mulls over how he's going to declare his candidacy, because I'm sure he will. And it will be exactly that argument. It will be seeing a Fillon and a Le Pen who are being touted by every prediction now in every poll to be in the second round. And by the way, it's also based on a lot of polling. And all of these polls have come out with the same result, that it will be the centre-right candidate, now we know, Fillon, against the far-right candidate, Le Pen. Now, clearly, we need to be very suspicious of polls at the moment, but still, there is a lot of evidence built up that the socialist candidate, whoever it is, won't make it through the first round. And by evidence, I mean polling evidence. Now, clearly, that can only be overturned if the turnout of the left, the centre-left, is so strong that it propels their man or their woman, and it's going to be a man, through into the second round ahead of either Fillon or Le Pen. That's the only hope that the left has. And as I said, the more fragmented the landscape of the left is, the less likely that's going to be. The less likely that Hollande or Valls could pull that off.
Well, it's in the current climate, I guess, nobody really wants to make solid predictions at the moment, do they?
Not at all. I think they have to be avoided at all costs.
Professor Shields, thank you very much for speaking to us today. A pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure.
Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi proclaimed today that Daesh, quote, does not have the guts to continue its fight for Mosul. However, sectarian disputes in the Iraqi parliament between the Shiite majority and the Sunnis appears to be straining much-needed unity. This week has seen protests against the bill passed last Saturday by the Iraqi parliament, which has legalised Shiite paramilitaries. Matthew Aiton has more.
Iraq's political leaders have reignited a dispute over the state of Shiite armed groups in the country, which some argue are hindering the country's efforts to reunite in the face of the Mosul offensive against Daesh. 40 days have passed since the biggest ground offensive in Iraq since the US-led invasion of 2003 was launched, and so far about a quarter of Mosul has been taken by the Iraqi government on the eastern side. While the battle rages on, the Iraqi parliament remains locked in a political argument between the Shiite and Sunni parliamentarians. On Saturday, the predominantly Shiite parliament passed a bill officialising and legalising the country's Iranian-backed Shiite militias that are partaking in the country's battle against Daesh in Mosul. Well, joining us to discuss this in further detail is Talha Abdulrazak, an Iraq specialist and researcher at the University of Exeter's Strategy and Security Institute. Talha, thank you for agreeing to talk to us. So, on Saturday, Iraqi lawmakers, predominantly Shiite, passed a law through parliament legalising the Shiite paramilitaries. Can you tell us what this law means in practice, please?
Well, I mean, in practice, this law has actually existed in some form or another over the past year, pretty much. It was announced by Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, I think, in February of this year. You know, motions were tabled in Parliament, I think, in June or July, over the summer, in any case. So really, what's happened is that it's just been formalised, essentially, and now it's got the backing of the Parliament. And what it means in terms of the future of the Iraqi state is that, essentially, we now have a parallel military force standing in parallel to the Iraqi army. What that means is, obviously, especially considering the religious and sectarian leanings of some parties compared to others, is that we have essentially a Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard, except for it's Iraqi this time, but still run by Tehran.
Sunni members of parliament have been boycotting the decision this week, arguing that the existence of these armed groups outside of the army and police is worrying at the least. Are these voices likely to be listened to? And if not, then why not?
No, they won't be listened to at all. I mean, the Sunnis that you have in parliament are generally, powerless, if not completely impotent. So you have people, for example, like Salima Jabouri, who's the parliamentary speaker. And frankly, and sadly, the best way to describe him is he's a token Sunni. So he's placed there along with there are even Sunni fighters within the Hashd al-Shaabi, the popular mobilization forces. But they are in such a minority that they can only be described as token Sunnis. So same thing when it comes to parliamentary politics. You have token Sunnis there who occasionally raise the odd whimper of dejection and rejection. But apart from that, nothing really gets done. Nothing happens. The same laws get passed on. And that's because you have massive Shiite blocs like the State of Law Coalition, which is still run by former Prime Minister Noreen Maliki, who's looking to make a comeback. And everyone knows Noreen Maliki is, virulently sectarian. He's a lot worse than Haider al-Abadi, to the point where they actually oppose each other and there's a power struggle between them. And my bets are that Noreen Maliki will be trying to shift Haider al-Abadi almost just as soon as Mosul is over.
Well, once Mosul falls into the hands of the Iraqi government forces, what do you think will happen to these legally sanctioned Shiite militias? It seems hard to believe that they'll just pack up and go home. And will this not worsen the resentment felt by many Sunnis in Iraq, which led in part to the opening up of a space for Daesh in the first place?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Again, we go back to the token Sunnis. So you're going to, I'm sure you may have already spoken to some people, but they will disingenuously say that, the PMF is a national force. It's going to even include Sunnis. It's going to bring people together. And the whole reason why it exists is because of a fatwa from Ayatollah Sistani and also because the Iraqi army crumbled. Well, here's the thing. Sistani's fatwa, if you actually read the text, says that he encouraged the Iraqi people to join the police force and the army. He didn't say create another paramilitary force, but that's exactly what's happened. So once Mosul is in the hands of the government, this force will continue. It's got its own committee. It will have its own parliamentary representation through, obviously, the political parties that these militia leaders have under their control. And things will carry on as normal. And if we look at people like Hadi al-Amri from the Badr organization, a key leader in the popular mobilization, the Badr organization is also a political movement. They have presence in the parliament. There's simply no way that they're just going to dissolve. And as you said, they're not going to pack up. They're not just going to go home. They're going to stay in force. And they're going to be another sort of... They'll be a guardian for the so-called Islamic revolution in Iraq. And obviously by Islamic, I don't mean the Islamic State in Daesh. I mean a Shiite revolution, a.k.a. in a similar vein to Iran.
So what do you see happening in Iraq after Daesh is eventually driven out of Mosul? Is that the end, or will the battle for Iraq's unity only just be getting started, do you think?
No, it will be a whole new chapter. I mean, there's a lot of intransigence. It's quite clear that people aren't, the Green Zone parliament and the regime aren't willing to make any tangible, real concessions to the Sunni community, Sunni Arab community. And that just means that it's going to continue into conflict. I mean, like I've mentioned previously, when the Sunni Arabs defeated Al-Qaeda in 2008, they weren't treated as fellow Iraqis. No, as soon as the threat was dealt with, they were marginalized, they were targeted, they were assassinated, they were incarcerated, they were tortured. And exactly the same thing is going to happen again once ISIS is taken care of in Mosul.
Okay, Talha, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Turkey is said to be, quote, very optimistic that the forthcoming US administration will either detain or extradite the reclusive cleric Fethullah Gulen. Ankara accuses Gulen of masterminding July's failed coup attempt. Turkish Deputy Prime Minister Dr. Newman Kurtulmus said he expects positive steps from the incoming administration of US President-elect Donald Trump. Donald Trump's National Security Advisor appointee, Michael Flynn, has already embraced Turkey's position, heightening speculation that action could be taken against Gulen. Liam O'Hare has more.
Donald Trump's shock election as President of the United States has thrown up many possibilities. There remains considerable uncertainty about how he will conduct
his international relations. But Turkey is hopeful that one consequence of the election will be the detention or deportation of Turkish political figure Fethullah Gulen, who currently lives in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania. Well, earlier I was joined by Edward Roger Owen. He's a professor of Middle East history at Harvard University. I began by asking him how likely he thinks it is that Donald Trump will take action against Gulen.
Very unlikely. First, it would create a great uproar within America and within in Turkey. I think large numbers of Turkish people are not convinced that Gulen is a conspiracy, or his followers are engaged in that kind of conspiracy. I think that Trump and the intelligence people will have been told that there is a distance between Gulen and his more radical supporters in the army and navy, who may or may not have tried to start that particular coup.
But Trump's national security adviser, Michael Flynn, has spoken out in support of Erdogan's position and hinted that the administration might take action against Gulen.
Well, I think it would be seen as part of a much more complicated rearrangement. It has something to do with the new Trump people and NATO. It has something to do with Gulen's supporters in America itself. And I think in the end, wiser heads will prevail in the State Department, and they'll find some reason for not agreeing to the extradition request.
And just how integral a figure is Gulen? Obviously, the noises from Ankara suggest that he is the mastermind behind the coup that took place in the attempted coup in July. How important a figure do you believe him to be?
Well, I think he's emerged. His importance is mainly as a rival to Erdogan, both of whom are pushing forward programs to make the Turks more Muslim. And he's a perfect person, fall guy for a conspiracy theory. I doubt very much whether he had anything to do with the movement of allegedly pro-Gulen forces in the United States, in Turkey. But it does provide a ready-made network for people who do want to conspire and who trust each other as a result of attending Gulen schools and so on.
And in terms of the United States' relationship with Turkey, obviously, historically, in Syria and Iraq, the United States have been allied to the Kurds and Kurdish movements. Do you envisage that changing at all with the Trump administration?
I don't at the moment, but it is extremely complicated, of course, and the Turks are required in some respects in northern Syria. They are enemies of the Kurds, as you know, so I think it will take some time for the new American administration to sort all that out.
And just lastly, obviously, in Turkey, we are seeing heightened repression of media, heightened repression of political opponents, and a lot of civil liberties being taken away. Where do you see this ending? What's the end game in Turkey for Erdogan if he's not opposed?
Well, it's what one might call an old-fashioned authoritarian regime. That is where the ruler controls every aspect of society, not just the political system, but also the educational and the cultural system. I think that's where Erdogan is heading.
Edward Roger Owen, very interesting to get your thoughts. Thanks so much for joining us on World in Focus today.
Thank you. A great pleasure.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back, and still to come on today's programme, the British government's investigatory powers bill, coined the Snoopers Charter, was given royal assent today amidst continuing protests against the bill and a very popular online petition to repeal the new laws. And those poor UFO spotters now state that aliens are utilising even more advanced technology to scupper their attempts to document invasions. Britain's controversial investigative powers bill received its royal assent today with the formal consent of Queen Elizabeth II passing the bill into legislation and becoming an Act of Parliament. That is despite widespread opposition and clamouring calls for it to be repealed immediately. The so-called Snoopers Charter gives the security services and law enforcers in the UK, that being MI5, MI6, GCHQ, the police and some other statutory authorities, the power to demand that all communications companies track users' telephone, web, social media, email and all other communications usage for 1 year. It's faced massive opposition because it gives authorities, which would include the tax agency, the health, transport, work and pensions department, and the Gambling Commission the right to collect bulk data on all internet communications. Spinnick's Jim Ensign joins me on the line. Jim, I know you've been following this closely since the bill was first announced, so could you just fill us in on the background to this bill?
Well, the whole thing goes back to, if you look at Edward Snowden, the former CIA contractor, who revealed the level of snooping going on. And suddenly everyone became very quickly aware of the fact that Britain's GCHQ, the government communications headquarters, had been working with MI5, MI6 and other agencies to collect data on people's communication. This goes back a few years to even before that revelation in 2013. To the idea of the state being able to look at what you're doing online. Now, the original Conservative government under David Cameron, whose Home Secretary, the Interior Minister in charge of such things, was a certain Theresa May at the time, tried to put a similar sort of bill saying, we will allow the agencies to snoop on you through mass surveillance, but we'll do it legally and with some safeguards to protect your privacy. They tried to put that through in 2010. When they were in a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, the Liberal Democrats said no and it went into abeyance. Well, finally, they've managed to get the Investigatory Powers Bill through Parliament, just about, and it received what's called its royal assent today. And the reality is now the Snoopers Charter is now law, and that allows the intelligence agencies to demand of all communication services providers to keep the basic details of everything you do online, email, web browsing activities, social media, anything you do online, to keep the metadata of that for up to a year for them to be able to investigate. That's what's happening today.
So does this actually allow the authorities to do more than they were already doing, or does it just make them legal to act on what they've already got?
As Shakespeare might have put it, there's the rub. What they're saying is that the old act, going way, way back 10 years, weren't fit for purpose for what is being done today. Terrorists and criminals use social media and the web activities. Of course, they tend to use the dark web more than anything else to do what they do. And they're needed. And the argument goes for the government's point of view in the UK, as well as other governments around the world, that they needed some form of new legislation to allow them to collect data in order to provide good counterterrorism measures, but with some sort of privacy. And that's why that's happening today.
And this bill has been controversial from the outset. So what's the reaction been like?
Well, quite clearly, all the way through the bill, people were saying, number one, what's the point of mass bulk collection? The issue here is bulk collection of data means everyone's data is collected. Millions and millions and millions of emails are collected and are kept for up to a year in the hope that at some stage, if the police or MI5 or MI6 or GCHQ or heaven knows the NSA in America, they want to find out and go backwards through your communications history. They will be able to do that once they're suspect. And the point was, well, why bulk collection? Why not simply go and ask, if you suspect somebody and you've got good enough reason to suspect them, you should be able to go to a magistrate, to a lawyer, to a judge, somebody, in order to get permission to go and tap their phone, to use that old-fashioned expression. So the number one objection was that you're actually snooping on ordinary individuals and you're snooping in their rights of privacy. That's the main thing against it. The police and everyone else in government have come back saying, no, we're going to put checks and balances in play to protect your privacy, and that's what should happen.
And what about this petition now to repeal the bill?
Well, that's been signed through. Now, basically, the government put online an e-petition service. If more than 100,000 people, and it's just gone past, I'm just looking at it now, 133,000, just over 800, once it's gone past 100,000 signatories, it has to be debated in the House of Commons. They can't say no to this e-petition. And the e-petition says that, you know, this is appalling and it needs to be repealed. The phrase to repeal means you unpick a bill that's gone through Parliament and gone into UK legislation. So it's gone past 100,000. So therefore, the government now has to set aside some time. Normally, it's about 4 hours of government time, and they normally find it on a sort of dreadful evening or dreadful afternoon, or sometime when there's hardly anyone turns up. So they've got to set aside some time for it to be debated in Parliament now whether or not they should repeal the Act that there's been so much trouble getting through Parliament.
And what do you think, Jim? What are the chances of this getting repealed?
None whatsoever, to be quite frank with you. I was talking to the campaign group Liberty earlier on today. They're going to still fight on, as are all the other Liberty groups like Privacy International, Transparency International, and all of those human rights groups. They will keep going. The reality is that these e-petitions go to Parliament. The parliamentarians sit around, and generally speaking, they talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and huff and puff and try to blow the house down. But in the end, all they agree on, and they actually take a vote that this, I could quote, this House has considered the motion 173,336 or whatever it is. And they all put their hands up and said, yes, we've considered it. But nothing actually happens. And that's more than likely to happen to this particular one. But I do predict, Carolyn, that there will still be pressure to put checks and balances on the Act. The Act may have become an Act of Parliament today, receiving the royal assent of Queen Elizabeth II, but the reality is, I think, the implementation of it is going to receive a lot of attention and potential legal action in the coming weeks, months, and probably years.
And of course, we, I don't know if you heard, Jim, but we had a former NSA whistleblower on the show a few months ago now from the movie A Good American, who told us that he had developed a system for the NSA which, instead of doing mass surveillance, pinpointed exactly who should be looked at, and then a warrant could be issued for their details. And he told us that 9/11 would have been stopped had they not used bulk data collection, as it creates too much data to then look through. It's overwhelming, and they inevitably miss things that they should be seeing. And so for national security, I mean, he gave evidence in the House of Lords stating that the IP bill was ridiculous. For national security, the government should be looking first at who they should be suspecting rather than collecting bulk data on everybody.
That's the haystack argument, and I couldn't agree with it more. I mean, the argument goes on behalf of privacy campaigners that if you just simply gather up all the hay in the field, you've just got one heck of a lot of hay to look through to find out what you need. And the whole principle of this, the bulk collection of data, was bulk collection is just simply going to waste loads and loads of time and effort, despite what algorithms you may put in place for it. You're far better off using targeted systems that target specific nodes. And this is certainly what your guest was talking about, actually going for very, very specific nodes of where you're more likely to find the data you particularly want. And I think that is an avenue that is going to be continued to be opened over time. Very simply, I mean, if you look at a particular recent case where I've been talking about, a person disappeared for 6 hours and they had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of hours of CCTV going through. And although they disappeared for 6 hours, it's taken nearly 45 days to look at each and every frame and each and every picture. If you multiply that by millions and millions and billions and billions into all these amazing bytes of information throughout the world of gathering, I think the argument that your guest a few weeks ago was putting forward will actually come to the fore.
Well, Jim Ensom, thank you. And finally, apparently those dastardly aliens are now utilising advanced alien technology to ensure that the batteries of the phones and cameras of witnesses die before they manage to video the alien spaceships. Well, that's according to statements from UFO spotters in Ireland who claim to have witnessed a UFO this week. So the pictures that are available of the event show a series of lights and an awful lot of fog. It looked a little bit like construction lights. I think we are all safe for now, fellow Earthlings, and that is all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget that you can listen again to this and to previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we hand over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show. World in Focus will be back with you tomorrow, and you'll be glad to hear that I will be joined once again by Jack Foster. Until then, from me, Carolyn Scott, goodbye.